and all I could see was the golden top of her head poking out from a mountain of her stuffed ones. Her latest paper umbrella had been added to the Dixie cup where she kept all of her other ones. She kept all the fortunes, too, flattened and smoothed out, and tucked neatly into an envelope marked Fortunes. She had been about 3 the first time I brought her a fortune cookie. Yee's had just opened up, and Skip and I went and checked it out on the way home from school. Mom showed Jody how the cookie worked. She cracked it open and let Jody pull out the slip of paper. Jody asked Mom what it said, and Mom winked at me and said, "It says Barney loves you." Jody was way into Barney back then. The look on Jody's face killed me. She totally believed in the cookie's power. Mom and I had swapped smiles. Hers was full of a selfless, satisfied joy. Dad was there too, but he was watching TV. I'd never seen Dad smile sincerely the way Mom did. Happiness to him was just another violent emotion as far as I could tell, something he turned into backslapping and arm-punching and used for an excuse to get drunk and destructive. As a kid, it seemed to me it was the same for all men, and I worried that maybe men could only feel anger and every other emotion had to grow out of it. When I asked Mom about it, she said I was probably right. Sometimes Mom's honesty got in the way of her parenting skills. I folded the note and put it back. I switched off Jody's Noah's Ark lamp that had once been mine, then Amber's, then Misty's. Most of the pastel colors had flaked off Noah and the animals, leaving them faceless and ghostly. I waited for my eyes to adjust to the dark. A weak spill of moonlight slowly seeped into the room, enough to make Misty's wrist sparkle. Everything else stayed black. I left and headed down the hall, passing Mom and Dad's room on the right. No one had been inside it since the day Dad's sister, Diane, had come over to strip the bed and pack up his clothes and personal effects. That's what she called them, effects. She taught 3rd grade and thought she knew everything. I cracked the door sometimes and looked inside at the glaring, flesh-pink mattress that used to feel so soft to me, and the framed poster of a Lake Erie honeymoon beach that used to look so exotic to me, and the empty ballerina-shaped bottle of a perfume called Moonwind that used to sound so beautiful to me. Now I knew it was all crap. It was like visiting Dad's grave. Down in my own room, I undressed and checked the pilot light on the heater. It was giving me trouble lately, and got into bed. Elvis circled the rug a couple times and lay down with a sigh. Last thing I remember was staring at the vague grayness of my unlit bulb against the pure black of the basement. And the next thing I remembered was the sound of Amber and her date on the couch. At first it was just random body shifting and muffled voices. I looked at my clock, 2:35 a.m. I sat up and swung my feet onto the floor. I heard a moan. I heard a giggle. Then a rhythmic furniture thumping started up. I didn't know how long I sat there on my bed with my ears strained and my fists clenched before I accepted the incredible fact of what they were doing. It must have been a while because when I opened my fists, I had dug bloody little crescents into the palms of my hands with my chewed-off nails. Amber knew she wasn't allowed to bring it in the house. I got up and slipped back into my jeans, threw Dad's coat on, and went to get the .44 Magnum Ruger Uncle Mike had given me. The sheriff's department did take all of Dad's guns, but Uncle Mike felt I needed at least one. I never knew when a rabid skunk might happen by. The shells were in my drawer with the Victoria's Secret catalog. I snuck quietly up the stairs. My plan was to go out the back door and shoot up his truck like Bonnie and Clyde's getaway car, but I had forgotten that the kitchen looked right into the living room and right at the end of the couch. I saw him above her. He wasn't even looking at her. He had his head back and his eyes closed. All I could see of Amber were her naked legs wrapped around his bare ass. I stopped and aimed the gun at his head. It would have been so easy. It should have been so easy, but it wasn't. It wasn't easy to shoot someone no matter how much you hated him or hated what he did, no matter how angry you were or how much you hurt inside. It wasn't easy. How had she done it? I turned away and walked across the kitchen, banging into a chair on the way, no longer caring if they heard me. I slammed out the back door, took a stand in the front yard, and started pumping shots in the air. I decided not to shoot his truck because then he couldn't get the hell away from me, which was my main goal by then. I wasn't crazy, I told myself, feeling a little relieved. Crazy people didn't think ahead. Amber's date came lurching out of the house trying to get his pants up. It struck me that he wasn't a very bright boy, or he would have been running away from the gunfire, not toward it. Amber came out behind him in panties and her tiny sweater.
You said he was a sound sleeper,
her date screamed at her.
Stop it, Harley, she screamed at me. You son of a bitch, you prick.
Her date grabbed her by the arm and shook her.
What are you doing?
He cried.
You fucker, I hate you,
she kept screaming.
Don't you have any parents?
I asked the boy as I stopped to reload.
Huh?
He said.
I hate you!
Amber shrieked at me.
Shut up!
He yelled at her.
Do you know what time it is?
I said. My voice sounded amazingly calm and sane, but I didn't feel that way. My insides were heaving, and my hands had started shaking again. I was glad I didn't have to aim at anything.
It's a school night, I explained to him.
He's fucking nuts,
the boy said, fumbling with the zipper on his jeans.
You don't have to go,
Amber told him. He gave her a crazy laugh.
Yeah, right,
he cried. I noticed Misty and Jody standing in the doorway behind Amber. I didn't care if they saw me ready to shoot someone, but I didn't want them seeing Amber half naked and thinking about what she'd been doing.
Get out of here, I said to the boy, and started walking back to the house.
He darted me a frantic look and bolted for his truck.
Go back to bed,
I told the girls as I pushed past them. A dozen questions sprang to their lips, but I silenced them all with a look.
You fucker!
Amber was still screaming at me. I walked into the living room and leaned my gun in a corner, then got down low to the floor and started pushing the couch toward the front door with my shoulder.
Keep it out of my house, I grunted at her.
Harley, what are you doing?
Misty asked me.
Go to bed.
It's not your fucking house,
Amber screamed.
Harley, what are you doing?
Misty tried again.
Get out of my way.
I propped open the front door. Getting the couch turned on its side so I could angle it out the door was difficult by myself, but I managed.
What are you doing?
Now Amber wanted to know.
Were you using something?
I asked her.
What?
I didn't see a rubber hanging off his dick, or did he have time to take it off?
Fuck you, Harley.
You get pregnant and you're on your own.
I'm already on my own, you fucker.
She threw herself at me and started hitting my back. I got rid of her with a good shove and finished dragging the couch down the front steps into the yard. I couldn't remember if I had filled the extra gas can at the end of last summer. Dad was always on me about that. He hated starting up the tractor for the summer's first mow and running out of gas. I went and opened the shed door. A black snake as long as my legs slid slowly from one side to the other. He didn't even have the energy to coil up once he stopped. He had been fooled into waking up too early like the worms and Bud's rabid skunk. Now he was freezing to death. Taking the hoe and lopping his head off might have been a more humane end for him. But if he lived, he'd keep the rats out of the garage and the moles from tearing up the yard. I left him alone and got the gas can. I gave it a shake. It was enough to douse the couch. I went to the kitchen for a box of matches. Amber was gone when I got back out front. Misty and Jody were on the steps. Misty started to ask me again what I was doing, but fell silent when a ball of yellow flames roared up from the cushions. The blood drained from her face, making her freckles stand out against her skin, as dark as coffee grounds. She flashed me a furious look and ran inside with angry tears spilling from her eyes. I didn't know why. It was a shitty couch. Suddenly my whole body ached, probably from moving the couch on my own. Dad had needed Uncle Mike and Aunt Diane's husband Jim to help him carry it in after Grandma died and he inherited it. I took a seat on the grass and watched it burn. Jody walked over and stood on the other side of the flames, her little body in one of my old white t-shirts, wavering in the heat ripples like a ghost. She didn't ask me why I did it, and I was glad for that. She came and sat down beside me and laid her head against my arm.
I can't wait to see Mommy, she said. Great, I murmured. She looked up at me, her smooth forehead puckered with adult concern. What's a rubber? Hey, I said quickly, glancing around for a distraction greater than a burning couch. Where did Elvis go? I haven't seen him since I went to bed. Her face brightened. I bet I know. She jumped up and ran over to one of the doghouses with my shirt flapping around her legs. She stuck her head inside, then pulled it out again, smiling and making a Vanna White hand gesture. Elvis slowly appeared, sniffed the air, and lay down in the dirt with a yawn. Chapter 4. I ended up taking Jody to see Mom after all, but only after Misty and Amber agreed not to go. I realized the problem had always been taking the three of them together, so I asked Misty at breakfast if she'd mind not going this time. She was still mad about Dad's couch. She gave me a quick, dark glance and said I couldn't pay her to spend 2 hours in a truck with me. Amber never came out of her room. Before I picked up Jody at school, I put in 2 hours at Barclays, unloading refrigerators, scrubbing them out, and setting them in the showroom, and another 3 hours in their truck delivering washers and dryers and stoves with Ray, a guy who spent all his time bitching about his wife and kids. I was in another foul mood, and I felt bad about it because I knew Jody was going to need me to spout a bunch of phony optimism after she saw Mom. That was usually Amber's job. And I admitted, no matter how much I hated everything else Amber did, she was good at comforting Jody. Jody was standing by the school office window when I pulled up, wearing her backpack and carrying her pink spring coat that was too small for her this year. She had on a flowery dress and tights with snags around the knees, and the silver little kid army boots that Amber had got her for Christmas last year. A lot of the kids dressed up for their prison visits. Some of them were forced by an aunt or grandma, but some of them made the choice on their own like Jody did. They were easy to spot. They were always preoccupied with keeping themselves wrinkle-free. I didn't understand the rationale behind it except to say to their moms, "Look at me. Look how cute and pathetic I am in my little dress. Look what you gave up." It was probably the same kind of fanatic neediness that drove some of their moms over the edge in the first place. Jody spent most of the drive prattling on about the Easter Bunny coming soon, and some girl bringing in a platypus beanie baby with the tag on, and telling everyone how her folks were going to sell it in a couple years for $1 million, and how the cafeteria served corn dog on a stick for hot lunch. She'd developed into a real chatterbox lately, and I was glad despite how annoying it could get. She didn't talk for a long time after Mom shot Dad. She started wetting her bed and wouldn't eat anything except red Jell-O jigglers. She had a different shrink than Betty, a guy with a beard who knew exactly nothing about everything. He wanted to put her away for observation. Amber freaked. For the next month, every time I came home after another futile day of scouring the county for a job, there would be Amber on the couch with Jody on her lap, not doing anything or saying anything, just holding her. Then one day I came home and they were playing dinosaurs and eating a bowl of popcorn, and everything's been fine since. Through trial and error, I had discovered Fridays were the best time to go see Mom. Hardly anyone else showed up. Only an idiot wanted to start out his Friday night with a prison visit. Weekends were the worst. The visitors' parking lot was an endless trickle of dressed-up little kids clutching homemade drawings and schoolwork. I bet a man's prison didn't get as many children. I bet they didn't have special visitation rooms called hug rooms where they could go to touch their kids. I bet their cafeteria walls weren't covered with stick figure families in front of crayon houses and spelling tests with stars on them. Jody said Mom said they used oatmeal to stick stuff to the walls since they weren't allowed to have things like tape or tacks or string. She said the tapioca pudding worked too. I imagined the visitors at a man's prison to be mostly lawyers and whores. It would make sense. Prison was a reflection of real life. And it had always seemed to me that once a woman had a kid, nothing else mattered about her. Being a dad might describe a man, but being a mom defined a woman. Jody didn't stop talking until we approached our exit. The prison was easy to see from the interstate. It sat at the bottom of the kind of valley pictured in every local bank calendar, except the calendar photos always had a big red barn in them instead of an enormous, angular gray cement building that cast a stark shadow like a scar against the soft hills behind it. I was sure when the government built it, they were just looking for an isolated area and weren't trying to make a statement. But they had done a great job pointing out the difference between man's ugliness and nature's beauty. I hadn't been paying much attention to what Jody was saying, but I was enjoying the excitement in her voice, the same way I had enjoyed listening to Callie Mercer at the ShopRite. I found it soothing and distracting, like the hum of Mom's vacuum, and once she stopped doing it, I felt strangely panicked. I caught her staring out the window and tried to come up with a topic of conversation to distract her, but before I could think of something, she said, "What's a lethal injection?" "Where'd you hear that?" I asked roughly. "Tyler Clark at school. He said Mom's going to get one." I glanced over at her. She was still looking out the window. "Mom's not going to get one," I said. "Esme said it's what the vet gives old dogs when they're having trouble dying. She said people don't get them because they don't need them. They die on their own."
"She's right."
"Mom's not going to die, is she?"
"No."
"I don't want her to die, even if she killed Daddy." My hands cut the steering wheel. Sometimes they did stuff like that, acted on their own. The truck swerved to one side, then jerked back into the right lane. Jody braced herself against the dashboard. "I can't talk about this shit while I'm driving, okay?" I said to her.
"Okay,"
she said back.
"What's the matter with you anyway?"
"Nothing."
"You're in a bad mood."
"No, I'm not."
"Yes, you are."
"No, I'm..." I stopped myself. There was no way to win this particular argument with a six-year-old.
"You are," she added.
"Jody," I started grumbling.
"You can't understand."
"Don't tell me I'm too little," she complained.
"I'm not too little."
"Yes, you are."
"No, I'm not."
"Yes." "Never mind."
"You want to hear a joke?"
"Sure." We got off the interstate and started down the county road. The field on the right-hand side was empty now, but by the end of summer it would be covered in sunflowers for as far as the eye could see. The inmates couldn't see them from inside, but Mom was arrested in August, so she would know they were out there.
"What does a vampire say when you do him a favor?"
Jody asked.
"I don't know."
A big smile spread across her face before she even answered.
"Fangs a lot."
I laughed. "That's a pretty good one." She waited for me to open her door after I parked, and when I did, she said,
"Fangs a lot,"
and burst into giggles again. She grabbed the picture she'd made for Mom, a kaleidoscope of neon marker-colored fruit with the words, "Fruit is good for you," written at the top. She was studying the food groups in school. At the bottom, she always signed them, "Your daughter, Jody." She headed across the parking lot, throwing smiles at me over her shoulder. She wasn't scared of anything. I hadn't been planning on actually seeing Mom this time. I'd planned to sit in the waiting area like I always did and read a worn back copy of Outlaw Biker. It was either that or Better Homes and Gardens. But Jody latched onto my arm and insisted I had to come too. She didn't want to go by herself. I started giving her all kinds of excuses, and the guard who was standing nearby, waiting to go over us with a metal detector, said to Jody, "Don't waste your breath, hon. Some people can't handle it." And that was the reason I broke my vow never to see my mother again for as long as I lived, because some stranger in a polyester uniform and rubber shoes made fun of me. Sometimes I hated being a guy. Jody eagerly submitted to the detector after I said I'd go. The first time she'd been subjected to one, she thought they were looking for candy. The year before, there had been talk about starting up body cavity searches for visitors going into the hug rooms after a woman had used her 10-year-old daughter to smuggle in pieces of a gun. I didn't believe in capital punishment as a rule, but when I heard about where that woman made that little girl put pieces of metal, all I could think was someone should take her out back and shoot her in the head. The ACLU could take a flying leap. Some shit was just very straightforward. Instead, they put in more surveillance cameras. We went in first. The room had four chairs. One of them was a rocking chair. I knew right away it must be for women with babies. I should have left then, but the door opened and there she was in a crappy cheap smock like a hospital gown. And it was yellow, faded sunflower yellow. Somebody's idea of a joke. Jody went running up to her. The guard stepped away and closed the door behind him. Mom bent down and scooped Jody into her arms before she noticed me. She didn't recognize me at first, or maybe there was a part of me that didn't want her to recognize me. A part that wanted her to mumble an apology for the misunderstanding so I could go back to not knowing her anymore. "I'm sorry," I wanted her to say. "For a second there, I thought you were my boy." "That's okay," I would say back. "I could have sworn you were my mom." Actually, she didn't look much like my mom at all. Not at any age or stage in her life I could remember. Not the anxious girl in the wedding picture fighting off dry heaves. Not the pretty, untroubled, ponytailed mom from my baby years, or the exhausted, short-tempered mom she became later, or the skittish, worried mom she became recently, or the untroubled mom, back again, driving away from her home forever, with her wrists in handcuffs and her clothes stained with her husband's blood. She was thinner now, older. She looked disturbed, but not in a bad way. A sort of worn, haunted calm hung about her as if she had finally reached some divine female plane where concern and disappointment were necessary and good. Her rusty hair was chopped short like mine. I couldn't believe Amber hadn't freaked out and ranted for days about her hair. "Harley?" she said. It was a statement of fact, even though it sounded like a question. I had been identified, spotted, caught in her sights. She released Jody and slowly stood up. "Harley," she said again, and her eyes filled with tears. She came at me. I thought she was going to hit me. I didn't know why. She'd never hit me before. I stepped back, but she cupped my face in her hands, gazed at it like it belonged to a newborn, then hugged me with all her might. "My baby," she said against my exposed neck, without sounding stupid or sappy or phony. Another statement of fact. The voice was what got to me. I could convince myself I was looking at a stranger or being held by one. But the voice was the only voice that had ever been kind to me without wanting anything in return. I had absorbed it into my consciousness before I had even formed ears. I tried, but my arms wouldn't rise to hug her back or push her away. All feeling left me except for a dull pain between my eyes. My free will had been crushed to bits between the rush of love I felt and the wall of hate that rose up to meet it. It occurred to me too late that seeing my mom for the first time since she started serving a life sentence in prison was probably a big deal. She finished hugging me without seeming to notice or to care that I didn't hug her back. I was a grown man, after all. I had never seen my dad hug anyone back besides Mom and Misty. She moved aside, and Jody came up between us and put her arms around Mom's middle. "You cut your hair," I said, surprised at how easily I found my voice. "A while ago," she told me, looking as pleased at my ability to speak as she had been at my ability to finally hit the potty without spraying the wall behind it. "Do you like it?" I squared my shoulders like she was a beatable foe. "No." She just laughed. Jody held up her picture to her, and Mom took it and raved about it. Then her eyes traveled quickly around the empty room before landing on me, full of concern. I thought she was going to touch me again, but she asked urgently, "Where's Misty?" The question stumped me for a moment, with its irrelevance. I shrugged. "She decided not to come," I said.
"Why not?"
"Harley asked her not to come," Jody corrected me. I glared at her.
"Well, you did."
"Why?" Mom asked.
"Because they fight," I blurted out, and then felt stupid. "They fight in the truck and it drives me crazy."
Mom smiled warmly at my confession, her obvious pride and fondness for me robbing me of all the hard-ass points I had earned over the past year and a half. I was glad Amber wasn't there to see it.
"Well, how is she?"
Mom persisted. "Who cares?"
"Harley,"
Mom lightly scolded.
"What's wrong with you?"
"What's wrong with you?" I repeated to myself, trying not to laugh out loud, my aching head filled with irate 4-star generals stepping onto body-strewn battlefields and asking survivors the same question.
"Nothing,"
I answered her.
"Why would you say who cares?"
"Because I'd like to know."
"I care about her,"
Mom said firmly.
"And so do you."
"And me too," Jody piped up. I looked from Jody to Mom and back again. I thought about Misty and Amber being here too, and how the four of them had been meeting here together for a year and a half now, privileged members of a hug room secret society. I could picture them laughing and gossiping, talking about clothes and hairstyles and beanie babies, never once bothering themselves with the facts of where they were and what had happened, not caring about blame and shame and paying bills. Then it suddenly hit me. The girls hadn't taken any of this shit personally. They didn't feel abandoned by her. It shouldn't have surprised me. They'd always been more accepting of Mom's screw-ups than I was, more willing to forgive her for mixing up who liked strawberry jelly and who liked grape, or who got her the good birthday present and who got her something stupid. They defended her on occasions when I expected an apology. I assumed their leniency came from being the same sex. It was just one more woman thing I would never understand. Like how they didn't want you to bug them, but if you didn't bug them for too long, they came looking for you wanting to know why you weren't bugging them. Or how all they cared about was looking good, but whenever you told them they looked good, they got insulted because you were implying there was something else wrong with them. Or how they were obsessed with proving they were as good as men by trying to do things only men did, when what made them better than men in the first place was that they weren't naturally good at those things. These were a couple of the things I had learned about them during my captive years among their kind. The only thing I had ever learned about men from watching my dad was how to settle for less.
"Don't you want to know where Amber is?"
Jody asked.
"Amber's a big girl now,"
Mom replied. She flipped her head the way women with long hair do to keep it out of their eyes. Then her fingers darted to her head, disappearing briefly into her short cut, and came out disappointed.
"I figured maybe she was busy with something else."
She went on hugging herself like she was cold, and walking a couple steps across the room.
"I know she started dating."
The innocent way she said it made me think of a boy in a suit holding a car door open for a girl in a dress, while her dad puffed on a pipe and called out, "Be home by 10, honey." It also made me realize that I had no idea what the girls had been telling Mom about our lives, and about me. "Define dating," I said. Mom gave me a look that said she didn't have the time or energy right now to decipher the hidden meanings of teen speak, and she took a seat in one of the chairs with the unthinking ease of someone plunking down on her couch. Jody instantly hopped into her lap and laid her head against her chest and started chattering. Mom gradually began to stroke Jody's hair, her presence next to her body acting like heat applied to a strained muscle. She kissed the top of her head and smiled, and nodded at her string of sentences. I had seen the same scene played out 100 times at home. Nothing was different here. I turned my back on them and walked over to one of the cameras hanging near the ceiling and peered up into it. I wondered how much video the state penal system possessed of people doing this. While I stood there, I tried to decide what to do next. I knew Betty would advise me to pop the question. Go ahead and do it right now. She was always telling me I would never have closure until I asked Mom why she did it. I asked her once what the hell closure meant, and she said, "Peace." I told her I already knew why Mom did it. Even Mom's attorney and the state prosecutor agreed on the reason why. The only difference was one presented it as a mother's love, and the other presented it as a mother's hatred. The question was, how could she do it? I didn't want to know the answer to that. The next thing I considered was getting into a big fight with Mom. It didn't matter what the fight would be about, but I decided against that, too. Mom and I didn't fight well with each other. Neither one of us had ever been able to put our hearts into confrontation. Betty called it internalizing. I called it being lazy and chicken. I always thought Mom and Dad were made for each other when it came to fighting. Mom was the perfect opponent for him because she took everything he could dish out, matching the intensity of his anger with the intensity of her patience, until eventually he got tired and retreated, and she could go about her life. One time, Dad got in a big fight with her while she was making Sunday breakfast. He got so mad he took an entire carton of eggs and started whipping them one at a time around the kitchen. Gobs of yolk oozed down the walls and made sticky pools on the tile floor. Misty was just a baby in a high chair, and she laughed and clapped. Amber cut and run. Being a kid, I thought what Dad was doing was pretty cool. But being his son, I realized I might be the next thing that hit the wall with a splat. I stayed in my chair, waiting. After he'd depleted his arsenal, he came raging back to the table and brushed the breakfast dishes onto the floor with a big swipe of his arm, and he went stomping out the door. We waited to hear what he would do next before deciding what we would do next. We waited for a dog to yelp, or the mower to roar to life, or the truck to start, or for ominous silence. Eventually, we heard the truck. I started eating again. Amber came back to the table. Misty craned her little head around and pointed out the door and said, "Dada." Mom grabbed a dish rag and glanced around at the dark yellow carnage dripping everywhere like the sun had bled all over her kitchen. Then she walked over to her grocery list and wrote eggs. I turned back around and stared at Mom with Jody on her lap. She caught me watching.
"You look like you want to say something," she said.
"Where do you keep the extra light bulbs?"
"Below the bathroom sink, way in the back on the right-hand side," she answered without missing a beat.
"Do we have any?"
"I don't know, Harley," she sighed. "It's been a long time."
She said it too easily, and I understood all at once that she had accepted our new lives, while I had only adjusted to them. I had never known there was a difference. But now it seemed clear to me that the first had been done willingly, while the second had been done in order to survive. I didn't want to be there anymore. I started noticing how small the room was. There weren't any windows. The chairs were bolted to the floor. The rocker was chained. There weren't any pillows or pictures on the wall. The cameras were made in Japan.
"I know, honey, it's very nice," I heard Mom say.
"Harley thought my banana was a crescent moon," Jody giggled. I swallowed a bunch of times but couldn't get any moisture into my mouth, yet I had a ton of it collecting at the top of my forehead and dripping down the sides of my face. I touched some with a fingertip and brought it to my mouth. Salty. Sweat. Claustrophobic. That was the word. A perfectly normal reaction to a tiny room without windows. I was not crazy. A crazy person would have killed that boy. A crazy person would have lived with that couch.
"It's funny, you sign your pictures the same way Harley used to," Mom said to Jody.
"Of course, he didn't sign them, your daughter." Jody giggled again.
"He signed them, your son. Amber and Misty never did that. I guess they assumed I knew who they were."
"Harley used to draw you pictures?"
"Of course he did. I could have sworn I showed some of them to you. I've got them all in a box in the basement along with Amber and Misty's school papers. He used to love to draw."
She lightly kissed the top of Jody's head again, and then gently grazed her cheek across it. This was the gravy part of motherhood. She still got it, even though she no longer had to deal with the bad stuff. The fights, the fevers, the bills, the spills, the nightmares, the questions, the future. She still had us kids, but we didn't have her.
"Your daddy didn't like it, though," Mom explained to Jody. "He thought Harley should be more into sports and hunting. Typical man."
"That's dumb," Jody said.
"Yes, it is. I remember how he used to drag Harley outside and throw footballs at him. How he used to hit him if he..."
Her voice trailed off, and she cleared her throat.
Oh, well. What do I know? Your Uncle Mike used to do the exact same thing to Mike Jr., and now he's at Penn State on a football scholarship. She laid the picture upside down on the floor, and I imagined it smeared with tapioca.
You want to be here?
I said, hoarsely.
Mom's head jerked up.
Harley, that's ridiculous.
I saw her map in my head. I felt myself being dragged along the black line to the place where it ended at nothing. I looked behind me, and instead of a little yellow house, I saw Mom done in crayon the way I used to draw her, a smiling stick figure in a dress with pale gray eyes and burnt orange hair. I still remembered the names of the crayons, Timber Wolf and Bittersweet.
No, I said, you want to be here.
She nudged Jody from her lap and stood up.
Harley, she said fearfully, and took a step toward me. The sweat had started dripping into my eyes. I blinked it away, but I still couldn't see her well. My hands started shaking like a palsied old man's. I looked down at them and saw sweat beads as big as raindrops forming on them. My breath came too fast for me to use it.
Harley, she said again, forceful this time. She lunged at me. I heard her cry out my name again. It unfurled from her lips, violent and sudden like a whip snap. My knees buckled and I collapsed to the floor. Her hands were on my face. They were shaking as bad as mine. She told me to be calm. She laid her head on my heart. I screamed. I scraped her off me and got to my feet, choking for air. I ran for the door and tried to yank it open, but it was locked. I pounded with my fists and screamed for somebody to let me out. Two guards rushed in and went straight for Mom. I watched Jody run to save her picture before running behind a chair. Jody had adjusted too. I sank back down to the floor. The guards pushed Mom into a corner. She held her hands up in front of her face and cried, "I didn't hurt him." That was the first time I saw words in the air. They hung in front of my eyes like a camera flash. Your son, Harley. Chapter 5. After my visit with Mom, I decided my biggest problem in life was getting rid of that piece of pipe in the yard left over from Dad's satellite dish, not accepting. I spent the weekend studying it. I could saw the pipe off fairly close to the ground with a hacksaw, but that would make it more dangerous because the grass would hide it, and Jody never wore shoes in the summer. She could tear open her foot on the jagged metal, and we didn't have any health insurance. We would if we were on welfare, or if I disappeared and the girls were put in foster care, then they'd have insurance. Social services had made this very clear to me. I could try digging out the cement plug, but that would take forever. I could dynamite it, but that might collapse our well. Probably the best thing to do would be to cut the pipe down as low as I could get it and put something big and noticeable on top of it. On my way to the truck Monday morning, I decided the couch would work until I found something better. Misty had covered the blackened carcass with an old scab brown bedspread. The smell of gasoline, burnt foam padding, and other flammable man-made materials still lingered in the air. I gave it a kick to see if anything had crawled up inside it yet. I pushed it over, and I felt better. I put in a full day at Barclays, then decided a Fruit Loops dinner wasn't worth driving all the way home for when I had to drive all the way back afterward for my shift at ShopRite. It was a warmer night. I decided to grab a bag of chips and a Coke at the store and go hang out at the self-service car wash across the road in the hopes a car full of girls would come through. I was halfway there, thinking about cutoffs and soapy thighs, before I remembered I had to pick up Jody at Esme Mercer's house. I could have called. Esme's mom would have run Jody home for me. But I drove out there instead. The Mercer's house was a strange one by local standards because the front faced away from the road toward the hills, and because it was all windows, and because they had built with expensive cedar, not siding, and left the boards natural. 6 years later, everybody was still wondering when they were going to paint it. I'd never been inside the house, but from the driveway I could see into the front room, jammed with plants and wicker furniture. Jody said they called it the jungle room, and Esme's mom went and sat there every night after she finished washing dishes, and and before she gave Zack his bath. Lights were burning even though it wasn't dark yet. The days were getting longer. Only one more week until daylight savings time. I wasn't looking forward to the extra hour or the hot weather on the horizon. I didn't particularly like the cold, but I liked being covered up. Last year, retiring Dad's jacket to the closet felt like giving up my skin. I pulled in next to Callie's blue Celica. The Jeep Grand Cherokee was gone. Her husband, Brad, drove it. He was vice president of something at Laurel Falls National Bank. Callie's dad was the president. It was a very small world. Their two dogs barked and strained at the ends of their chains until I got out of my truck and they recognized me. Then the blonde collie mix started whining, and the black lab started tearing in circles around his doghouse.
Dogs never forgot the bearer of affection, no matter how infrequently he came by. I walked over and untangled the lab and scratched them both on the chest until their eyes glazed over. The front door opened, and Jody ran out. The dogs started barking again. She saw me and scowled and went running back inside, yelling, "It's him! I don't want to go!" I took a moment to appreciate the view. The Mercer property dipped down to a circular pond, sitting in the middle of a lawn the color of pool table felt. A twisting section of clear, pebble-shiny creek lay at the foot of their hills. And they were their hills. They owned them. Not like our hills. We just lived on ours. Callie's grandfather had willed her 50 acres along with the mineral rights, which meant the old man never sold out to the coal companies while everybody else around him let their land be stripped raw. Besides the Virgin Mary, he was a dead person I would have really liked to meet. Through the hillside trees, I saw the railroad tracks, the same tracks that led to the mining office behind Skip's house, the same ones we used to fantasize about following out to California after we bumped off Donnie. Zack Mercer ran out next. He grinned at me and whirled around to go back in and ran into his mom's legs. She grabbed him gently by the shoulders and told him to slow down. She looked up and gave me a slow female smile. "How are you, Harley?" she said. "Okay," I said back. Then she whipped her head around in the direction of the dogs and gave them a steely military stare. "Shut up!" she yelled harshly. Esme and Jody exploded from the house and took off for the swing set. Zack tore after them. Callie composed herself and walked toward me, smiling in a stirring way again. I remembered our meeting at ShopRite, and how she had gone from a childish excitement to a deep depression with the quickness of a finger snap. "I just got off the phone with Misty," she said. She didn't have any shoes on, but she crossed the sharp gravel driveway without flinching, making me wonder what the bottoms of her feet felt like. "I called to tell you Jody could stay for a while, and then I'd run her home for you," she went on. "We should have planned on that in the first place." "That's okay," I said. It turned out to be a beautiful day. "Aren't you hot in that coat?" "No." She moved closer to me. "Did you have dinner?" "Yeah." "But you haven't been home yet." "I ate in town." "Oh." I got the feeling she was taking notes again, not out of nosiness, but because she wanted to reconstruct me later at her convenience, piece by insubstantial piece, like a house of cards. She lifted one of her bare feet and brushed the top of the other one with it. "Well, I have something for you anyway. You want to come in for a minute?" "In?" I said. She turned away from me again and shouted at Esme to quit pushing her brother so high on the swing. "In the house," she finished. "Sure," I said. I tried not to watch her walking in front of me, but her jeans fit like someone had rubbed the color on with a piece of powder blue chalk. They had been worn and washed so many times. I bet the denim felt like a puppy's ear. I tried not to think about that while I tried not to watch. The inside of the house was all wood, too, even the floors, except for the kitchen floor. It was made of stones of all different shades of gray, set in mortar, and polished to a high gloss. It was one of those open houses where the rooms weren't really divided off with walls, and the downstairs ceiling went all the way up to the upstairs ceiling. A
A big stone fireplace separated the kitchen from the living room, and a wall of glass shelves covered with knick-knacks and framed pictures separated the living room from the jungle room. There was nothing but air between the shelves, making it seem like the plants were in every room.
I didn't see a TV, so I guessed the big room with the fireplace was a formal living room, something we didn't have and my mom always wanted. She said any decent house should have one room for the TV where the family hung out, and another room without a TV for people to visit in. I never saw the point in that because everyone I knew preferred to visit in front of a TV.
The room didn't look formal, though. The furniture looked beat up and there were toys everywhere. Through the doorway at the end of it, I saw a mirror over a chest of drawers, and in the mirror, an unmade bed.
You want to sit down?
Her voice brought me back from the bed. I was grateful for that. She glanced at the table and chairs. The chairs were bamboo and had sawdust-colored cushions, and the table had a glass top.
The dinner dishes were still sitting on it.
We bought that table before we had kids, she explained, when she noticed me looking at it.
So far, no one's thrown a dish through it, although Zach's been practicing. She came over with a dish rag and wiped off the tray on Zach's high chair. Their dinner smelled great, like apples and honey and charcoal. I couldn't even remember what real food tasted like. My mom wasn't the greatest cook in the world, but these days I would have given just about anything for a piece of her bland meatloaf or one of her overcooked chickens.
You have a nice house, I announced.
The sound of my words made me cringe. I couldn't have come up with a more uninspired thing to say if I had spent all day trying.
The worst character on the worst TV show would have come up with a better opening line. I knew people on TV were fake, but that didn't stop me from wanting to be as smart and funny as they were. And there was nothing like constantly falling short of unrealistic expectations to make someone feel like giving up on real life completely.
Thanks, she said.
I never saw anyone use rocks for a floor before, I added. I saw brick once.
It's terrible if you drop something breakable, she said. Stuff shatters like you wouldn't believe. But it's pretty. I love this rock here.
To my amazement, she dropped to all fours, still holding the wet cloth, and motioned for me to join her. I got down there with her, and she pointed out a pale silver-gray rock full of glittering black and ivory chips.
If you look very closely, you can see a tiny vein of pink going through it. You don't notice it if you just glance at it. You really have to look.
I did, and she was right. I couldn't help looking at her, too. I wondered how much time she had spent staring at her kitchen floor to notice something like that. She sat back on her feet, and her arm brushed against mine. I had on my coat. Skin didn't even touch skin, but a flash of heat went shooting to my crotch, giving me a serious boner. It wasn't a good feeling, though. I realized it was supposed to be, but it ripped through me too fast, like fire eating up a trail of gasoline. I practically jumped up and took a seat at the table. She was still staring at her rock. She hadn't felt a thing.
Do me a favor, Harley, she said, standing up and taking a couple plates with her over to the sink. Eat that last pork chop for me.
I adjusted myself inside my jeans. My zipper was killing me.
I had pitched my last pair of underwear that morning.
The money I was going to spend on new stuff, I had ended up spending on a Happy Meal and a new dinosaur for Jody to keep her mouth shut about what happened with Mom.
No thanks, I said. Oh, come on.
I already ate.
A big guy like you can't polish off that one little pork chop.
I didn't say anything. I waited for some big guy to answer.
Please, she said. Otherwise, it's going to the dogs.
What about your husband? I asked.
He won't want it, she said, kind of irritated. He went out to dinner.
Okay, I said. I stabbed a fork through it like I was afraid it might escape and plopped it onto the dirty plate in front of me.
You want a beer? She asked.
Sure. She came back with a Michelob. I almost had it in my hand before she asked,
Wait, you are old enough to drink, right?
Well, not legally.
How old are you?
19,
Well, 20. Just about 20. I'll be 20 in a couple months.
That's it? She breathed out and took a seat across from me. My God, you're a baby.
I couldn't believe I didn't lie. I might as well have told her about Brandy Crow, too, and how I had freaked out at the prison with Mom, and how I used to pee my pants when Dad hit me too hard, and any other embarrassing thing I could think of that might help her figure out I was a total idiot.
I thought you were older, she added.
I'm old for my age, I said with my mouth full of pork chop. She laughed. I didn't mean it to be funny. I was dead serious. But it was okay with me if she thought it was a joke. Ask any woman what was most important to her in a man, and she would say a good sense of humor. Of course, they were all lying, but a sense of humor must have counted for something, or they wouldn't have always been bringing it up. This is great, I said about the pork chop, and I wasn't sucking up to her. It was the most tender, juicy, flavorful thing I could ever remember putting into my mouth.
Thanks, she said, smiling.
She seemed to like the compliment about her cooking more than the one about her house. Jody loved them too. She ate 2 whole chops by herself. The door banged open and all 3 kids came running in. Callie's kids were vanilla skinned with big dark eyes, Esme with blue-black snow-white hair, and Zach with a fawn-colored mop. They skidded to a stop and stood beside each other. Esme leaned into Zach and he gave her a 2-handed shove. A pink tongue popped out of Esme's angel face, and Zach grinned like a soldier who's seen too many battles.
You forgot to close the door, Callie told them. Can we have something to eat? Esme asked. You just had dinner, Callie said. Go close the door. We want dessert. We want dessert, Zach echoed. I haven't even cleaned up the dishes yet, maybe later.
Did you eat these pork chops? I asked Jody.
Yeah, she said. I loved them.
You hate pork chops.
I hate your pork chops. They taste like napkins.
It's probably just the marinade, Callie laughed. It's a very simple one. Apple cider, lemon juice, honey, soy sauce. I could give you the recipe.
And your macaroni and bean soup recipe, Jody added eagerly.
That's an easy one too, Callie said, then gasped. Where are your shoes?
They were all barefoot.
Outside, they answered.
It's not summer yet, she scolded them. Go get your shoes back on right now.
Cruz wore shorts today to school, Esme argued with an imperial tilt to her chin.
Which Cruz?
Cruz Lewandowski?
Do I care what Cruz does?
His father's an educator, Esme pointed out. Even Callie rolled her eyes.
His father's a gym teacher. Now go get your shoes. And Zach, it's time for you to come in.
They all went tearing out again, their pounding feet on the wood floor sounding like a tiny fleeing army. Callie sat down across from me and opened the beer for herself, sighing.
There are 5 Cruises in their class. Do you know what that's all about? She asked me.
The only Cruz I know is Santa Cruz, and I have a feeling that's not what people around here are naming their kids after.
I think it's some guy on a soap opera, I answered.
Oh, okay. That would make sense.
She took a swig from the beer and stared off into space. I finished the pork chop. I didn't think she had noticed, but she reached out and pushed a bowl of potatoes in my direction without looking down at them. All mothers had that empty plate reflex.
Funny how you can like a name and then find out the reason for it is stupid and then it's ruined, she said kind of absent-mindedly.
And vice versa. A name might seem really dumb and then you find out the reason for it is interesting or sentimental and then you like it.
I wasn't listening to her, but I heard her. I was busy shoveling potatoes in my mouth and staring at her because she wasn't looking at me, so I didn't have to worry about eye contact. She had 1 perfect black freckle in the hollow of her throat, like a speck of pepper.
I always wondered about Misty, she said. Did your mom just like that name, or was Misty born on a misty day?
I swallowed the last spoonful of potatoes. They had a ton of garlic in them. They were great, too.
My dad picked out Misty, I answered her.
She's named after some chick on Hee Haw from when he was a kid. I think she was a centerfold, too. Dad never got over her, I guess. Again, I was being serious, but Callie laughed. She brought her beer bottle to her lips and giggled around the neck. I could see her tongue inside the brown glass. I started feeling hot again, but it was a slow melt this time, not incineration. I realized we were having a conversation. "Where did you get Esme from?" I asked. "It was the name of a model and mistress of one of my favorite artists, a French impressionist." She held up a finger, signaling for me to wait before slipping out of her chair and out of the room. She came back lugging a big, glossy book. She set it down in front of me and flipped it open to a sloppy picture of a vase of flowers, a bottle of wine, and an artichoke. Then she sat down again and went back to her beer. I studied the page out of courtesy. "He paints like Pierre Bernard," I said. She gasped. It was the only time I had ever heard a real one outside of bad TV. "You know who Pierre Bernard is?" she asked. "Sure," I said. "You must have a wonderful art teacher." "I don't have an art teacher," I told her. "I haven't had art since third grade." She put her beer down, frowning. "I can't believe it. Don't tell me they finally cut the art program," she said angrily. "I know they've been threatening it for years. They've got some nerve saying there's not enough funds when they just budgeted all that money for new football uniforms and a bunch of videos so kids can watch Moby Dick instead of reading it." I didn't bother telling her the only movie about a whale in our school library was Free Willy. I couldn't believe how mad she was getting over art and books.
I knew she had gone to an out-of-state egghead college that no one around here had ever heard about because it didn't have a good football team.
I hoped she wasn't the intellectual snob type who thought she could venture out into the real world and bring civilization back to the natives, and we were all supposed to crowd around her with our jaws hanging open while she dangled her enlightened views in front of us like shiny beads. I wanted to tell her this and see if she would get madder. I thought about what it would be like to get her mad enough to try and take a swing at me. Then I would have to grab her and restrain her. I pictured her struggling and screaming for help, and me clamping my hand over her mouth.
She would open her mouth to try and bite me, and I would stick my fingers inside.
She would start gagging, but I'd push them down deeper and deeper into her throat until she fell to her knees. Then I would turn her over and press her face against her favorite rock. "That really upsets me," she went on. "I feel like driving over to the superintendent's house right now just to put him on the spot and hear him stammer through the ridiculous justification for this." I almost didn't hear her over the blood pounding in my ears. My hands were killing me under the table, and I looked down at them. They were white-knuckled and clenched. I slowly, painfully unfolded my fingers and saw tiny new welts near the crescent scabs where I had broken the skin Friday night listening to Amber fuck a guy who was too stupid to run away from gunfire. I should have shot up his truck for that reason alone. That would have been my justification. I blinked. The word hung where Callie's face had been. I blinked again and she was back. She was looking right at me, and for a moment I was sure she had read my thoughts. I swallowed and hoped sweat wasn't pouring down my face. "Nobody cut the art program," I confessed. "Art's an elective." "Oh." She gave me a quick, embarrassed smile. "Why don't you have it?"
"It interfered with a study hall."
She took another gulp of beer.
"Then how do you know who Pierre Bernard is?"
I pressed my throbbing hands together. Nothing hurt worse than a human scratch except for a human bite. My dad only bit me once, and it was because I bit him first. My mom said I was the only one of us kids who went through a biting phase. My mom had a set of note cards that used to belong to her mom, I explained. She got them as a souvenir from the Art Institute of Chicago. Mom's from around there originally. They had one of his paintings on the front. Table set in a garden.
"So you're familiar with his work?"
she asked eagerly. "I'm familiar with his note cards." I watched her throat pulse as more beer slid down it. I pulled my eyes away and dropped them back to the book. At first glance, I hadn't liked Callie's artists nearly as much as I liked Mom's.
The painting on Mom's cards had lots of warm green light and soft smudged colors, and a tablecloth with a bright pink stripe, the kind of table I would have liked to sit at with Jody. The painting in the book was set in a shadowy corner of a room. There was an open window and it was day outside, but no light was coming in. The flowers were a glaring white, but looked waxy and dead. The bottle had been opened, but was still filled to the top with a weak brown wine. But the thing that really bothered me was the artichoke. Its sharp leaves were outlined in blue-black, and each tip had a dot of red so bright it looked wet. Looking at it again, I realized the reason I didn't like it the first time was because it gave me the creeps. But that was exactly why it was a better painting. It was probably a lot harder to scare someone with an artichoke than it was to tempt someone with a sunny garden. "I like impressionists," I said. Right after I said it, I regretted it, realizing immediately that I had to add something to it. I fumbled around inside my head, not trusting any of the observations I came up with. Until a couple minutes ago, I thought impressionism was Dana Carvey doing Ross Perot. "They don't seem to care about what things really look like," I tried. "It's like they care more about how looking at something makes a person feel." She smiled at me. It was a beautiful smile, one she made with her eyes, not just her mouth. One that came from her heart, not just her head. Because I had touched something inside her that no one else ever did anymore. I didn't know how I knew that, but I did, and even though I wanted to violate her 100 different ways physically, I didn't want to go anywhere near her soul. "That's the definition of impressionism," she said softly. "Yeah, I know," I lied. I got up from the table. "I'm going to be late for work," I told her. "I've got to go." "I'm sorry," she said, getting up too. "I didn't realize you were on your way to work. Wait a minute." She left and came back with a sloshing Rubbermaid container. "Hot and sour soup." She held it out to me. "You said you liked Chinese." I stared at it, but didn't take it. "Please," she urged. "Esme and I are the only ones who like it. I have so much extra." I took it. I didn't even say thank you. I never thanked her for the dinner either. I didn't think about it until I was in the truck. I should have gone back and said it. Driving away, I caught myself staring at her hills and wondering if her grandpa gave them to her before or after she got married. "Where's Esme's dad?" I asked Jody. She pulled some school papers out of her backpack. She wanted to show them to me now in the truck since she would be asleep by the time I got home from work. "Her mom said it's his night out with the boys," she answered me. "She said her night out is going grocery shopping. She said that's marriage for you." I looked at the star at the top of Jody's addition and subtraction worksheet and nodded. If I had a pretty wife who could cook, I would never leave the house except to go to work so I could keep her. The rest of the time I would spend having sex and eating, and I would be deliriously happy. I didn't know how happy she'd be, though. I wondered if I would care. Chapter 6. I went ahead and told Betty about my visit with Mom at our next appointment a month later. At first I wasn't going to because I didn't want to talk about it, but Betty wasn't all bad, so I did it for her sake. Sort of a personal favor. Boy talks to mother for the first time since she killed his father. It was a shrink's wet dream. She almost fell out of her chair when I told her. It got her more excited than the time I told her about how Dad used to take Misty hunting with him instead of me, and every time he'd say to me, "She's more of a man than you'll ever be." Shrinks loved it when dads cut down their sons. Verbal emasculation, she called it. I didn't care what it was. He was right. It wasn't that Misty was butch. She was slight and freckled and had a glossy ponytail the color of an acorn and long, thick eyelashes like tiny feathers from a baby bird's wing. But she was definitely a tomboy, especially around Dad. They watched pro wrestling together and worked on the tractor mower together, and he took her to the Penn's Ridge Speedway to see the stock car races, and she was definitely more of a hunter.
Betty got up and left her office and came back with a glass of water for me when I started talking about Mom. She had done the same thing when I told her about Dad and Misty. I figured it was something she had read in one of the psychology textbooks she kept at her other office where she saw real patients instead of charity cases. There was probably a whole chapter in one of them about water and Kleenex and when it was appropriate to offer them. I left some things out of